Hello, everybody. It's Bo James, and we have a great episode of Outlaws to Independence for you today, as we're joined by Bob Smith, who worked for Westing Publishing and what is known as the Aftermags, and we're going to talk about the PWI 500 and Wrestle America and a whole lot of other great things here today, but I want to give a couple of updates. We recorded the episode you're getting ready to listen to Sunday afternoon, and we did not know the total effect and devastation of the flooding here in the Appalachians. We were still getting reports and still finding out things. In the description of this episode, I've put a couple of links if you would like to help. Also on my social media, I have ongoing threads of places that you can drop off supplies or ways that you can help if you're in the area. If you're able to do that, thank you. Please do. If you're unable to help, just give it a share. Just getting the word out there will help. I want to let everyone know that I am all right and my family is all right, but you go just a few moments from our homes and it's total devastation, loss of life. There's still people missing. Businesses are gone. Homes are gone. Roads are gone. Railroads are gone. Bridges have fallen. We've never seen anything like this here in these mountains. I talk about in the opening here with Bob and John about KC Thunder and about Joe Wheeler. I was able to get a hold of KC Monday night. I have been in contact with him. I have been in contact with Joe Wheeler. Both of them severely affected by the flooding in Asheville, North Carolina, not far from where I'm at, just across the state line. The city of Asheville has been devastated. Businesses lost. Both of them lost their businesses. We're going to be doing a benefit wrestling event coming up at the end of October to help out KC, to help out Joe Wheeler. We'll be collecting items there. Follow me on my social media. I'll let you know more about those events. I'll let you know more about what we'll be collecting and what the needs are. If you live inside the floods and you're listening, help is on the way. We're coming. God bless you. I hope for the next 90 minutes we are able to make you forget about the world's troubles, no matter where you're at, in the floods, out of the floods, whatever it is. Every episode of this program we do to entertain and to educate you on a profession that I love. I have a great talk with Bob Smith here about the wrestling magazines and reliving my youth of being covered in the magazines. For the 90 minutes that we were doing this, I got to forget about what is going on in the world around me. But now we see exactly how bad it is. Now we know how much is in front of us to rebuild. And that's what we're going to do because we're Appalachian strong. We're Appalachian proud. And sometimes, no matter how strong and how proud you are, you need a hand up. And right now, the Appalachians need a hand up. If you're able to help, there's links in the description. Thank you very much. Now let's get on with the program.
Someone called us outlaws in some old magazine. New York sent a posse down like I ain't never seen. Don't y'all think this outlaw bit's done got out of hand? What started out to be a joke the law don't understand. Was I singing through my nose? It got me busted by the man. Good Lord.
Hello again, everybody. Bo James here with another big episode of Outlaws to Independence, and we have a lot to talk about. But I want to kick off by saying thank you to everyone that has reached out asking about myself, asking about my family, asking about the floods. This part of the world is underwater. This part of the world, there's counties, there's communities that are destroyed. And if you will follow me on my social media, King of Kingsport, this where you find the podcast, I'm going to start putting links up to where you can help and can donate to this area because we need it. We need prayers. We need water. We need socks. We need underwear. We need food. We need some love here in these mountains. And me being an Appalachian through and through, Jim Axelrod from CBS News told me, you are a part of these mountains, and these mountains are a part of you, and that's the truth. My family has been in these mountains since Daniel Boone. My ancestors cut the Wilderness Trail with Daniel Boone. Everybody here in East Tennessee and Western North Carolina knows somebody affected by this. My longtime dear friend, Joe Wheeler, my commentator for Southern States Wrestling for the past 26 years, has lost everything almost. His home is safe, but his business, his job, all underwater. He saved his life. He saved Helen's life. Thank God Almighty for that. My cousin and my tag team partner for years and years, KC Thunder, we have not heard from. We cannot get a hold of him, and we have tried and tried for days. And I was told yesterday morning his community, his neighborhood is underwater. If anybody knows about KC, let me know. Again, I'm going to share on all my social media the links. You can email me, whatever. I will send it out to who you can help, and it will stay here local and help local. Don't run to Red Cross. Don't run to FEMA, because only about 30 cents of every dollar actually goes to victims of the situation, and a lot of it will not find its way here to these mountains. And I hate starting off with this bad situation, but that's the life that we're dealt right now. So we're going to try to make you forget about it here on Outlaws to Independence today, because we've got a great guest. And for all of my Appalachian brothers and sisters listening to me, the other two men on here today, yes, they have funny accents, because both of them are from New York City. First of all, let me bring in my co-host, and he is the reason that Cosmo Kramer is afraid of clowns, Mr. John Boucher.
Hello, Bo.
John.
We sorry got to hear it's...
Yeah, it's bad here, John. It's bad. No. Oh, but we're going to make people laugh and entertain people and educate them here today, I hope.
Hopefully.
So let's bring our guest on, a man that I owe a huge thank you to, and I'm going to give it to here the best way I can when we get talking about this program. But he worked for Pro Wrestling Illustrated. And Bob, how many years did you work for PWI?
Man, what do you mean I got a funny voice? What are you talking about? I worked from 1988 to 1995, the last 2 years freelancing for PWI. And then I worked for WCW itself magazine for a while. I worked with Sandy Krebs at Wrestling's Main Event for a while. I worked with Bill Apter when he was doing WOW for a while, and then I faded away until I started podcasting a couple years ago, and I haven't regretted a minute because I'm having a blast. How you doing, other than the horror that's going on there? And I really feel for everybody. I love the South. I love Tennessee. I love Memphis like nothing else. Yeah. I love Georgia. I love my band. I used to be in a band, and we used to go all the way, what I used to call the 95 corridor, from all the way where we were down to Florida and parts west. We had so much fun, and I met so many nice people, and I feel for everybody. And you know something? I want to tell everybody, help's on the way. I will assure you that help is definitely on the way.
As we were talking about off the air here, people are coming in here from Canada, from all over America. I last night, Southern States Wrestling, my promotion ran Mount Carmel, Tennessee, just outside of Kingsport. And I had some of the boys tell me, hey, we need to cancel. Hey, what are we going to do? And I said, we're going to run, because we may be able to make people forget about it for 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And last night, as I was sitting there, my friend April runs the box office. I'm right beside the box office, and Tom Pritchard and I were doing a meet and greet. We had three families that came to the matches last night that were severely affected by the flood and are staying in shelters, but they wanted to forget about it, so they came to the wrestling matches. And I went in and I gave that Newton Rockne speech to the boys and the girls working last night. Hey, let's make them forget. And everybody left there last night happy. Everybody left there smiling. And everybody left there not thinking about the flood, but had to return to that. But wrestling is a great escape. And to me as a child, because all of us on this podcast grew up long before we had the internet and we had all this stuff. So we waited on those wrestling magazines to come out every month so we could see what was going on in the areas of the country that we couldn't get on TV. I didn't get cable television out here to where I live in the country till I was 10 years old. So before that, unless I was at my grandmother's, the only way that I could keep up with anything was The Wrestler, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, you know, whatever I could find out there. And as a kid, I dreamed of being a wrestler and I dreamed of being in those magazines. And I did not have a clue that before I turned 20 years old, I would have been in just about every magazine in print. And there's a few people that I got to thank for that. And I talk about it in my first book, Handsome Jimmy, first of all, who I just inducted. I was the man to induct him into the Memphis Wrestling Hall of Fame last week, which was a great moment for us.
Mm-hmm.
I was handpicked by him to do the introduction, and I love that man. But he met another man that we all love, or knew another man that we all love for many years, Mr. Bill Apter. And Handsome comes to me one day, and he hands me Bill Apter's card, and he said, I saw Willie Will last week, and he said, start sending stuff about your promotion and about you directly to him. And I said, really? He goes, yes. So every Sunday, I would sit down and hunt and peck and type out or have my mom type out the results of every card I was on that week, and we would fax them to Bill. I would fax him the ratings for my promotion. At the first of every month, I would mail him a packet of new pictures, action shots, pose shots. And man, from like 1991 until 2003, we were in every magazine out there. And it was because Bill Apter cared. It was because friendships and relationships. And then came along what I want to talk to Mr. Bob Smith about today, the PWI 500. And we're calling this in the ring, folks. There's no notes. Usually me and John have 17 pages of stuff in front of us before we start.
37 pages. Yeah.
But today we're going to call it in the ring. Bob, I want to know, how did you do the 500 before the internet, before email? How did you find all of these people?
This is a little bit of trivia. It's not even trivia anymore because I've been on so many other podcasts and stuff, but I wrote the first two basically all by myself.
Yeah.
I think we sat around and formulated a top 10 or a top 20, but I did all the rest of it all by myself. And you're right. There was no internet. There were no cell phones. Can you imagine this? No internet, no cell phones, no immediacy. To do a job like that, you had to be in the office. You couldn't do it from home. Everything was what we had written about, the old match results we had. We kept a list of wrestlers with weights, heights, you know, years started and all that stuff. Like, we knew that Abdullah the Butcher started in 1955. You know, we had everything going like that. And it was a combination of what I knew from working there for so long, what I knew from being a kid watching and TV and reading every wrestling magazine I could get my hand on, and also just keeping my nose to the grindstone. But the number one reason that made it easy, and the number one reason why the job was as easy as it was Bill Apter. Bill Apter was our conduit between the wrestlers in our office, the organizations in our office. Shoot, the guy who sold the pop at the arenas in our office. Bill knew everybody. He's a gadabout. You know Bill. He's a gregarious guy, and he's got a way of ingratiating himself. And he was, without Bill Apter, there would have been no PWI. There would have been no The Wrestler, Inside Wrestling, or all those other things. Without him, without his contacts, without his good relationship with every organization in the world, we would have been nowhere. So I give Bill Apter as much credit as I do myself for this first couple of years, because without all the stuff that he had acquired over the years, we had photo files and notes and old articles. I just went through everything as closely as I could. And I was the guy that did, what helped is I was the guy that did the regular ratings at the time, like the normal ratings page. So, you know, coming up with 500 guys wasn't that hard. Coming up with where they lived, what their weight was, you know, where they were built from. That was the hard part, you know, and I knew a lot of wrestlers that I had no information of, but I knew about them. And I watched every bit of videotape when I was on that job that you can imagine. I used to get the tapes from Emmy Yates. Excuse me. That means nothing. There's a lady named Emmy Yates in Atlanta used to send me the Joe Pesicino wrestling block in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
So that's 6 to 8 shows right there. We would get Calgary. We would get – there was a Florida startup promotion. There was everything, and I watched every single frame of it. So when they sat me down to do that, of course, the whole 500 was my idea. I hate to say this. Here's the stupid part about this. Stu Sachs, our publisher, said, we need something to goose sales a little bit because our sales were down a little bit. He goes, how about we do the top 100 wrestlers? And I'm sitting there going, gee, why don't we do 500? And he goes, you want to do it? And I went, sure, that doesn't sound so hard. Well, I am telling you, I was there. I worked probably 2 weeks from 6 a.m. to midnight to finish that thing. And can you imagine? We're all sitting in front of computers right now, right?
Yeah.
There were no PCs. There were no computers. We had a word processing system.
Wow.
Everything had to be done by hand. Everything. And then during the midst of this thing, the thing broke down. I lost some files. I had to redo things. It was kind of a nightmare. But when I was done the first year, which was 91, I felt such a sense of achievement. Because you know what? It only took 2 weeks after that thing was in the newsstand. I knew the fans liked it. I didn't think the wrestlers would get so serious about it.
Oh, my God.
I never dreamed. I didn't think. I had people calling me. How come I went down 45 slots from year one to year two? I mean, they were really, really serious about it.
So very serious. Yes.
So to think that I had my little pinky in a little bit of wrestling history like that makes me very proud. I worked it hard. Now I don't even know who does it anymore. I'm just glad that PWI is still around after all these years. And I will say that it was an accomplishment. And I got a bonus too. Stanley Weston never gave bonuses. So I was very, very happy.
The boys took it very serious.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing the first edition in the dressing room, not on the newsstand, in the dressing room, and it was being passed around, and guys were looking to see if they were in it. And if they weren't in it, there was somebody in there that they knew.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like, why? Why is he in here and I'm not in here? And I'm and when I started getting in it, the only thing that I cared about, do I get a picture? Because here's why. I didn't care what the number was. I didn't care what. If your picture was in that magazine, people knew you.
Right.
If your picture was in that magazine, the independent promoters now had a new star that, hey, we're bringing the guy in. It was blah, blah, blah. So every year when that magazine came out, me and KC would get it. We didn't look for the numbers. We went flipping. Look there, cuz, colored picture. We're booked for the next 6 months. And we knew it. We knew it. And then came along Wrestle America and the Guide to the Independents.
Mm-hmm.
We wrestled for everybody on the East Coast, me and KC from Georgia to New Jersey. So we knew when that magazine came out, we were not only going to be mentioned in the Southern States Wrestling section, our home promotion, my promotion, but we knew we were going to be listed in dozens of other promotions. We're booked for the rest of the year, cuz we're good. And for that, Bob, thank you, thank you, thank you, because you kept us booked for many years off of that idea of let's do the 500. We would have never got in the 100, but we got in that 500 a bunch, and we stayed booked.
So what year were you first in?
Oh, gosh. 95, maybe?
That sounds about right. Yeah, I would think that's right.
And then I was in it until I after Bill, here's another thing. Some people know, some people don't know. Bill Needham. Did you know Bill Needham from Knoxville? Okay.
Wait a minute. Was he the tell me who he was.
He owned a printing company, and he had promoted wrestling and concerts and everything, but he did a lot of freelance stuff for PWI and for
Bill and stuff.
So okay. Bill used to come to our shows, and he would take pictures. That's a lot of the first stuff that we sent to Bill after came from Bill Needham. Then my mom got involved in taking pictures and doing the stuff because here's the thing for the folks listening out there. independent wrestling in 1991 through 2001 was nothing like it is now. We were very few wrestlers, but more promoters. That's how we were booked all over the place. We were true journeymen. So Bill's trying to cover everything, and he gets to talking to my mom one night, and he says, "Hey, can you do this, this, and this, and blah, 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 and send it to me?" So we started doing that with Bill. Then Bill Needham, and then after Hansom had talked to Bill Apter, my mom directly started working for Bill Apter doing stuff. And most of the colored pictures that you see of me and KC and Ricky Harrison and all the people, my mom took those pictures. My mom's name is in the results all the time as the correspondent, Faye Ferguson. That's my mom. So,
oh, yeah. Wow.
So we had the interconnections with Apter and all the magazines and all the stuff. And here's how serious guys took this 500. Me and KC have been in it for like 2-3 years now. And we're getting the pictures. We're getting the pictures and all the offshoots, you know, of the magazine network there that you guys had. Wrestlers start coming to us and saying, "Hey, where do we send our money?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He's like, "You know, who do we pay to get into the deal?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" So we didn't have a clue. Stan Lee, my dear friend who wrestled for me for years, and he was always in that coverage too, him and Eddie Golden. Stan starts getting the same questions. We're riding to a town one night, and Stan goes, "Here's what it is. I finally got somebody to give the scoop on what the deal is. They think we're buying our spots in the 500 and in the magazine." Jealousy. How could these hillbillies be getting this and we can't get it? Well, it's because relationships and connections. Now, I kick myself in the butt all the time when I think about this, because I should have said, "You give the money to me. I'll get you in there."
You know, I've been hearing that stuff forever too. Oh, they paid to get in. I will tell you right now, that is complete horse pucket, man. That is absolutely not true. You know, Bill, everything we did was we loved the wrestling business. We want to get as many promotions in our magazines as we could. Now, granted, we weren't going to put you on the cover in the PWI anytime, but we could get you in the magazines. And I can't tell you the number of people that I wrote about, like in the introducing features. None of that was payola. We did it because we thought people were interesting. That's it. And we thought the readers would think they were interesting. I saw Rob Van Dam long before he was Rob Van Dam. I rushed to get him in the magazine, first national publicity he ever had. I thought he was good. That's it. Yeah. That was as far as it went. So anybody who says anything was anything else is full of beans. That's all.
Right. But I wished I would have taken her money now.
Damn right. I don't blame you.
Like on doing the results, did you do the results in the magazines where that, you know, they would have page after page, state by state?
Mm-hmm.
Who went through that process? Because you had to be getting so many a week coming in.
We did. And you know what? That was Monday, every Monday.
Yeah.
We got into work. We all sat down, the wrestling writers, myself, Dave Rosenbaum, Andy Rodriguez at that point. We had a guy named Chris Bernuka. We had a couple people come and go, Gersh Kuntzman and Bill. And we were all on the phones all the first part of Monday. I'd have George South calling me, have the NWA calling me, I'd have the AWA calling me. Andy would have somebody else that he talked to. Dave had somebody else that he talked to. Bill had his usual bunch of people. He knew Dusty Rhodes like really, really closely.
Yeah.
And other than the WWF, of course, we were blocked out by the WWF because they started their own magazine in 84. So they stopped giving us any type of anything.
Yeah.
So we had to kind of base those records on our own match results that we would get from around the country. So we'd have match results sent by the fans. We would have people calling us and giving us, you know, what had happened during the week. I would sit down, at least the way I did it. I can't vouch for everybody else who ever wrote the ratings, but I would sit down and tabulate the wins and losses. Like any other sport, we treated it like a sport. We did. And there's the other big lie I hear about them. Oh, promotion set up them ratings. No. The only time we would let a promotion send us a top 10 is if we didn't see it and we didn't know who the guys were you know, yeah. So we would allow them. But as far as the ones we had access to, that was completely done as if I was doing batting average for a baseball team. It was the same thing. If Hulk Hogan lost two matches to Paul Orndorff, Orndorff went up in the ratings. You know, even if they were DQs, it would be that type of thing. We treated it like a sport. Nobody ever got in the top 10 because, you know, somebody paid us off or some dumb stuff like that. And so I don't know what to say other than we treated it like a sport. In fact, when I left, there was a section in the ratings on the right side. We did a three-issue compilation of ratings so you could check the trends. We were serious about the stats, man, and they were as legit as we could make them. Where they perked it? They couldn't be perfect because we didn't get every result of every car in the country, but we had enough of them to base a pretty good ratings. All I know is I was backstage for an NWA show. Ric Flair goes, "How come not the ratings?" I said, "You were injured." At the time when we were doing the magazines, and back then it was a pain in the neck because you would send the magazine to the printer, it'd be 6 weeks before it hit the newsstand.
Yeah.
So a guy could be injured when you wrote it, but he could be back 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
So by the time they get the magazine, you go, how come not the ratings? And I had to explain it to him. He wasn't happy with the answer, but that's what the answer I gave. So.
think about that if you're a young person listening to this now. You had to wait 6 weeks from the time it went to press to find out the news. But how long did it take to get it to press?
Oh, we would send... get it from us to the printer?
Yeah.
Oh, not. Oh, yeah. That was a different era. Now you would just send a PDF through email, and then they'd get it right away. No, back then you had to have essentially
all the separations and the whole.
Yeah, we used to call them blue lines, right?
Blue
they were essentially blueprints, and they smelled like blueprints. Right. It's like the thing they gave you at school from the machine. You'd smell it first.
Yeah. Oh, there's that smell. Mimeographs.
And then we'd have to do our last final check looking at those blueprints, and when we'd ship that and all the flats, there was everything. It was cut and paste. Everything was on a board, which was a big piece of cardboard. The cover, the individual pages were on these cardboard sheets. And then they would go to the printer, and it would take just one day. I think we got them there overnight because it was local. But the difference, the thing that took it long to get it printed was, I think it got printed right away. It's the distribution it took all the time.
Yeah.
You got to realize it went all around the world, these magazines did. And, you know, they were on trucks and they had release dates, which in my state was every Tuesday. Other states was different days. So somebody might have had it in New York on a Tuesday 5 weeks after we sent it. But maybe somebody down south where you already didn't get it for another additional 2 weeks. And that was bad because, you know, titles would change in the interim and all that stuff. And nothing could be up to the minute. So we did the best we could with what we had. And, it took a while. From the time we sent that big fuzzy envelope, I remember it was like a leather envelope we put that stuff in. It would go to a courier, not the mail. And the courier would take it to the printer. So it was aggravating. I remember we switched to Kappa Publishing. Kappa Publishing right before I left, and that's why I left, by the way. When Kappa Publishing bought from Stanley Weston the magazine, all those titles, one of the first magazines we sent to them, they had a magazine that came out with the current cover and an old magazine on the inside. I almost had a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
It was like it was printed wrong. They had a new cover, but the old magazine. So they reprinted the old magazine, put it in the new cover, and I'm having a stroke. I'm like, I don't believe what I'm seeing. And so I went back to the blue lines real quick, and I looked at them. I said, Stu Sachs was the publisher. I said, Stu, these are perfect. There's nothing wrong with these. They screwed up. And that was just one of many problems we had during the turnover to the new company. And it was at that point when I started looking for a new job, because it's like, I just smelled the bread cooking, man. It wasn't going to be the same. It just wasn't going to be the same company anymore. And I'm not putting anybody down at Kappa. They wanted me to come with them, and they gave me all the parameters, but I'd have to move. Couldn't move. I bought property. I can't. I was a young man. I just bought my first property. I couldn't just, you know, it was enough money in it to just uproot myself and go to another state. And they were in rural Pennsylvania, so I decided to go out in the world and do other things.
How, when it was still the Westons, how big was the office staff?
Bigger than you'd think. I mean, I bet we employed, let me just put my thinking on. I think in the editorial department there was, I can remember this one. 3, 4, 5, 6, 8. I think as we sat 9 people in the editorial department. Then the photography department was 2 to 4 additional people. Then we had the boxing department because we did KO and other boxing magazines. Mm. So there were four writers in that department. And the art department had at least 6 people. And then we had a typesetting person. So, and then we had the administrative staff in the front and Stanley's office. It had to be 12 people in the administration. So I think we hired about 60 people. And in the basement of the building, we were on the 5th floor. Stanley built this 5-story building. We were on the 5th floor, but in the basement was our distribution center and back issues. Huh. And that was another 4 or 5 people that had full-time jobs. So when I'm doing a mental count, I imagine it's close to 60 people.
Yeah.
You know?
And technology took all those jobs away almost, you know? Bob, how many of the people, like I'm a regular listener to Bob's podcast. I love the Outdated Wrestling Hour, and it has the best opening theme of any podcast out there.
Man, you've been after my own heart, man. Give me the funk. Give me that funk, man. I like it.
But, so I know you're a fan. I know you're a deep-rooted fan, but were all the people that work there fans?
That is an excellent question. I can't speak for the administrative staff or the people who did, some of the odder jobs, you know, or the photographers or whatnot. But I will say this: the people in the editorial department, absolutely. Boxing guys were serious boxing guys. The wrestling fans were wrestling people, and with the exception of Craig Peters, who got the job because he was a really esteemed top writer and editor, and he got the job, I think, for his skills, but he learned the wrestling as he went along. So by the time he worked there for 15 years or so, by the time he left, he knew as much about wrestling as any of the others did. I walked in. I'm not being egotistical. I know I walked in there with as much wrestling knowledge as anybody else on that floor. I know I did from when I sat down. They gave me a writing test when I was there for my job interview.
Yeah.
And I just nailed it. They said, write a story about Sergeant Slaughter. Oh, okay, he's in the AWA now. Oh, Stanley Blackburn, bang, 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 bang. Wally Carbo, bang, 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 bang. Al DeRusha, the referee, bang, 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 bang. I just banged it out in like 5 minutes, and it was mint. It's exactly what they did.
Yeah.
And I got the job. And you know what? I dare say I was probably the most qualified hire that they ever had. Because I was doing boxing, too, in the beginning when I started with the company. And I had won an award a year and a half earlier for an interview I did with Mike Tyson, a national sports writing award. Yeah. All of us there at those magazines, many of us, worked for serious newspapers and other publications. It wasn't – that, I think, separated our magazines from the others in a way in that – and I'm not putting anybody down. I loved all the rest. I loved the Kitzer magazines. I like George and Paul Towns, Colorful Magazine. I liked everything. But I will say that the difference with the London magazines and the others was simply this. Number one, we had the best art director, Ken Morgan. Those covers were fantastic.
Yes.
Number two, we were legitimate writers and journalists who happened to be doing wrestling, whereas the other magazines would hire a wrestling fan to write.
Yeah.
And I think it gave us a readability factor that was far above most of the other stuff that was out. Not all of it, but most of it. Like, I love the Kitzer magazines, Wrestling News and Wrestling Review. Yeah. Oh, God. Those Haggett pages in the back with all those match results. Oh, baby. I was a full-grown adult buying those things, man. I love those things. I was like 18, 19 years old. I was a newlywed when I was like 22. And I was like, wow, I love. I would still buy the wrestling magazine. So I read every wrestling magazine I could get my hands on my entire life. And combine that with my real, you know, love. I watched all those shows. Like I said, I think I was the perfect candidate. And time has proven that. I mean, it's like, I could walk in. I'll never forget. Stu Sachs, who was the publisher, walks up to me one day, and he's got a picture of the Sheik jabbing somebody in the head. But you couldn't see the head. He just saw an arm.
Yeah.
So he goes, do you by any chance know who this is the Sheik is fighting on this? So I flipped the picture over. It said Amarillo, 1977. And I went, Jose Lothario. They went back to the Jose Lothario photo file, right? Found the shots when he was up, like when he was doing the offense, and it was definitely who it was. So I picked out who the wrestler was from just his arm, because he had a dusky colored skin. And I'm like, man, What would they do without me?
When I was wrestling in Memphis 26 whatever years ago it was.
Right.
Saturday mornings at TV, ever so often, we would play this game. Me, Jerry Lawler, and Bill Dundee, they would bring pictures of wrestlers or of themselves, and they would lay it on the table, and they go, "Who's that?" So I'd tell them, and they'd flip it over, it'd be on the back, and they go, "How the hell?" So then they would throw it down and go, "When was that picture taken?" So I would look, and I'd say, "Spring of 1980. "How? How do you know that?" And I said, "Hey, man, I was super fan. I can remember everything that I saw as a kid. I can't remember half of what I've done. And when I was getting into wrestling, old timers couldn't remember stuff I would tell them, but now I am to that state."
You know, I think I'm a little psychic, and I'll tell you why. You'll enjoy this story. Okay. When I was a kid, 11, 12, 13 years old, wrestling in my area was on at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. You know what else was on 11 o'clock a Sunday morning? Church. That's what was on. So during those early years, I begged my parents, "Let me stay home and watch the wrestling." Something inside me told me I didn't want to see it. I had to see it. Something, I could feel it, you know? So for years, I begged and cajoled. And finally, when I was about 15, maybe 16, they said, "All right, I'm sick of hearing your talk. Stay home, but you're going to have to go to the other thing later in the week." I said, "Fine, that's perfect." Like, there's another session on Thursday or something. First Baptist Church, Catskill, New York, okay?
Yeah.
So they let me go to the other session, and I could stay home and watch the wrestling. And I insist, if I didn't have that knowledge base from watching all those shows early on, I never would have been the writer I was later on. But something inside me, just like you're saying, something tells you, here's you and me, Bell, we thought it was important, didn't we?
Yeah.
It was important. It wasn't just a hobby. It was important to know these things.
Yeah.
And you can just feel it, right? Probably when you're my age, 15, 16, you knew what you wanted to do in life, I bet, right?
I was already in the ring at that time.
There you go.
Here's something else that I have always been impressed with you, with After, with Brandy Makowitz. Anytime I've ever met anybody from PWI, and I'll give myself a little pat on the back if I am a very good self-promoter. I saw the internet for the first time, and I'm like, I got to get on this. I knew this was the next thing. Mm-hmm. But before that, it was the magazines. Now it's podcasting. I've always been good at promoting myself. But there's also a lot of other people out there that are just as good or way better. So I don't always expect everybody to know who I am. But every time that I have met somebody from PWI, I have went to introduce myself. And one of the coolest moments was Bill After. I said, "Hello, Mr. After." He goes, "Hey, Bo James, I know who you are." You know, so how you can keep all of what comes through that office, like you said on Monday.
Right.
To know who everybody is and where they're at and what they're doing, that was a art and a job in itself. And I don't know how y'all did it, because I can't keep up with half of what I do and the people connected to me do.
I don't think I could do it now, but back then you got into a flow, you got into a rhythm. And once you knew what you had to do and how long you had to do it, you could do it. You know, and here's why. You liked what you were doing.
Right.
You know, you were a fan of all the things that you were writing about. So there's a difference. You know, if I worked in a deli and some guy walked in and said, I need 7 pastrami sandwiches every morning at 10 a.m., I'd hate the guy. Because he was just creating work for me, right? I did work at a deli for a while, by the way.
Right.
But in this case, if Bill After would hang up the phone and go, "Oh, geez, the WWF just signed Steve Kern. They're going to call him Skinner." I had the luxury of being one of the few people in the United States that knew that and could swing around and go, "What? They're making an alligator man out of him? What are they doing?" You know, you had these type, and you could hear hilarious conversations, like somebody asking, Bill After got off the phone, and Craig Peters spins around and goes, "Hey, Bill, was Kamala there?" He was calling Kamala, the Ugandan giant. And yeah. Bill's answer was, and I quote, "No, but Mrs. Kamala says he'll be home at 6. Only, that's when I knew I had a very unique job, and not everybody could... It all said with a straight face, but we all busted up laughing, thinking of the ridiculousness of somebody called Mrs. Kamala. So that was just, it was just too good. Too good.
John, do you have any questions? I know you're an avid magazine reader, too.
Wall is surrounded in an avalanche of magazines could happen at any point in time. The years when, especially when the PWI 500 started, and around the time you guys started doing the weekly newsletter.
Oh, God.
That was such an interesting time in pro wrestling. Like, what sort of, like, as the territories are sort of on their last legs, as we, you know, it was a completely different, you know, 1991 looked completely different than 1985. I was wondering if you could talk at all about how you and the magazine handled that on your end. Did that, you know, how did that affect you guys? Did you guys have to, was there less content for you guys to work with? Did you guys need to find more content? Was that one of the reasons why the PWI 500 started?
John, that's a really good question. No, we had plenty of things to write about. But you got to remember, magazines were business. And every wrestler in the world wanted to be on the cover, but only a few got on there. And the reason they got on there is we had a sixth sense. We knew who would sell as a cover person and who didn't. Devon Erich sold magazines. Ric Flair sold magazines. Hulk Hogan sold magazines. You know, it's like whoever was super hot, super popular at the time usually got a cover slot. And the others would be on the cover, but the main image would be of somebody really important or the current champion or what have you. But back then, you make a good point, because things got serious in the early 90s. You had the steroid scandal. You had other scandals. You had real news. You had the Iron Sheik getting caught in a car with Hacksaw Duggan. You had Jake Roberts in trouble. You had all these things happening. And that's where I was glad I had a news background, because we had a switch on a dime.
Hmm.
Like, you remember the old kayfabe articles, you know?
Yep.
The hidden torment that drives Rick Steamboat, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
It's his wife.
Yeah, well, I won't go there. I won't go there.
Excellent.
But in any event, we turned back into newsmen a lot. And Dave Rosenbaum on our staff was an excellent, you know, straight news writer. And I had done news writing. And we got serious stuff to cover. And we could not mince words. And we could not ignore it. It was the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Remember when the WWF on the cover of the New York Times, there's a headline that says, WWF admits wrestling is fake. That's when the New Jersey Athletic Commission, they were trying to eliminate those fees. And in order to do so, they had to admit it's all a show. I handed the New York Times to Stu Sachs, and his face turned white because that was the ultimate break of kayfabe. And you can't even imagine that, Bo. Yeah. I mean, you know how the mores of a wrestling locker room were. Everybody was real serious about this. And this was like taking a twig and snapping it in half. And how do we cover this? What do we do? So as far as the content, it was more than enough content. The problem was, what's going to sell and how do we handle these important topics? That was a very topsy-turvy time to be part of the magazines back then. I thought we did a nice job walking the tightrope. It doesn't hurt that a lot of kids buy wrestling magazines, so you didn't have to do too much serious stuff. But I remember writing an article that has haunted me the rest of my life. I wrote an article about Nikita Koloff, whose wife was dying.
Mm. She did die. Yeah.
I did an interview, a legitimate interview with him, his wife, and I fell in love with both of them. I thought they were the most amazing people, and you know, they had great faith, and they really loved each other like nothing else. And when she died, it felt like a member of my own family died. And I'm aching to see him again in person. I haven't seen him since like 91 or something like that. Mm. I'm aching to talk to him again, because to see it was hard for me to write. It was so sad and real. And I was given this task of writing an article like that. That you don't read stuff like that in magazines. You read Bulldog Brower, Tough as Nails, you know.
Yeah.
This was real stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to exploit it, but I wanted to report what was going on. And they were so good about it. And I consider it my best moment there at the magazines. I think for Wrestling 88 was the title of the magazine, Wrestling 89. Well, I'm just will always be a major Nikita Koloff fan after that. I don't know what to say other than I didn't expect that when I got a job with wrestling magazines.
Mm.
I would imagine we report that she was in ill health or something like that, but I didn't report we would actually get interviews with them about the topic. And so things were changing, John. You know what I'm saying? We had more than enough to fill the magazines. The problem was, you'll like this, our sales started to really fade around 89.
Hmm.
We were on top. In 1984, Craig Peters tells me, for a spell on the newsstand, Pro Wrestling Illustrated outsold Sports Illustrated. Just on the newsstand. Now, we're not talking subscriptions. Just right. on the newsstand. And they were getting bonuses, and they were riding high, and everything was wonderful back then. Cut to 4 or 5 years later, and when the scandals hit, the interest in wrestling started to go down. Parents didn't want their kids watching the show and stuff like that.
Hmm.
So it was getting tougher and tougher and tougher to you know, call this an all-family thing. And part of it was seedy, and then you had the allegations of sexual misconduct and all this other stuff going on. So it was getting harder. So what did London Publishing decide to do? Let's do more titles. Let's do the PWI Weekly. Let's do Wrestle America. Let's do Wrestling Unbridled, whatever the heck.
Yeah.
That doggone weekly came out. And that was added to what we did on Monday. Remember what I told you, Bo, about, you know, we did all that other stuff? We added that. Monday was PWI Weekly Day. So that's when, but it kind of helped because we assembled all those records right then and there. And if you remember the weekly, it would open up like the New York Times, and the back of it was all those results. Basically, it was all results.
Yeah.
So we could just paste them in right there, do a cover story, a couple other little things, a quiz, you know, things like that. But it took time, and we were starting to get grouchy. you know, we were starting to get grouchy. I was a managing editor at that point. I know I was getting overworked to the hilt, and I was starting to. Bill Apter would say, "I remember you snapping at people back then." I go, "It's not like you." And I went, "Dude, I didn't have a moment to spare on myself. It got really, really tight, you know." Yeah. And we started to snipe a little bit, and you know, there was the uncertainty of us selling the magazines and stuff like that to the other company. It was not the most pleasant time while I was there. At that point. But we persevered. Finally, they killed off the weekly. Things calmed down a little bit, and we could get back to doing what we do. But I hope that answered your questions, John, because there were so many factors at that point.
Yeah. Actually, you know, my follow-up was going to be, you already answered it, was like, how was it difficult to balance that real life?
Yeah.
You know, with real the non-kayfabe stuff.
Yeah, because real life was creeping in, man. Real life in wrestling was creeping in all the time. Yeah. And they were making it do that. When they told the New York State Athletic Commission, it's just a show, how the heck do you handle it?
Yep.
Do you ignore it? Do you write about it? Do you make a big cover story about it? I don't remember how we handled it. I think we just sat down and said, business as usual on that.
Yeah, just keep.
You know, let them go to the. And, you know, there's another factor. As you remember, that era is when the newsletters started taking off.
Yep.
The Meltzers, the Wade Kellers, all the others. And a lot of fans were switching. I'd be naive if I didn't tell you they were. They were switching from, oh, those fake wrestling magazines to the real nitty gritty. And here's the secrets. Here's the real names. Here's all this stuff we always wanted to know. And nobody's, you know, so it developed a new audience for that, where I think some people turned away from us and went to them. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So that was one more factor we had to deal with, too. I'm just very happy that in 2024, there is a Pro Wrestling Illustrated. I am so happy with that.
Me too.
And if you've read it recently, it's good.
Oh, yeah.
It's real good. I mean, it's a slick magazine now. It's the same flavor, the same type of type and everything. I'm really happy with what's happened to that magazine in recent years. I think they, especially the last 2 years, I think they've rebuilt the thing like crazy. And they did it for Jerry McAvaney and Brian Solomon and Al Castle and the other staffers there deserve a big tip of the cap, because we still got a National Wrestling Magazine. I can't imagine a world without a National Wrestling Magazine. I
love the fact that people still bring the old magazines for me to sign. I still sign them, you know. So the fact that they're not digital, they're hard copies in hand. Mm-hmm. All of them didn't survive, but some of them are going to survive forever. So some of them are out there. Bob, my friend, me and John talked about him a little bit on the last podcast. Kenny Short, who was super fan, he was the first historian of East Tennessee. He passed away in August, and he left all of his research, all of his wrestling collection to me. and I've been sorting through it for 2 months and still have not got through everything. But there's over 400 magazines in his collection. And it's Inside Wrestling, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and The Wrestler were his three favorites. And how do I know that? Because he has every one of them. Up until about 1990 or 2000.
Right.
All the way back through. So I've got all of them in great condition and totes put away, but he also had the Kaiser magazines and he had all the other stuff. So he's reading and looking at everything. And I love the fact that I can show them to my little niece and nephew who are ate up with the wrestling sickness. But that leads to this question. What magazines were you getting at the office? What were you said you looked at all the magazines out there. Were they coming to the office for you to look at to see what the other magazines were covering, or you just looking out of interest of your own?
We were just looking out for ourselves.
Yeah.
The only thing I remember coming to the office every week was the Wrestling Observer and maybe the Wade Keller thing. I don't recall us subscribing to the other magazines. And I think that was smart.
Yeah.
You don't want to play follow the leader, copy what someone else is doing. You got to be original in any type of entertainment. I think if you're a musician, anything, I think you should follow your beat, you know, follow the beat of your own drummer. Don't copy what somebody else is doing all the time. And we had our own flavor, and I think we kind of just stuck to that, to be honest with you. I don't recall us ever saying, oh, gosh, you know, WWF magazine did this. Now we got to do it. No, I don't even recall seeing that in the office.
Right.
We didn't even have the WWE magazines coming in. I'd see it on occasion. And, I lived in New York City where they had them big old newsstands. Every so often I'd pick up a competitor's magazine, bring it home and check it out just to get a flavor for it. But I was so knee-deep in what I was doing, I didn't care what they were up to.
Right.
And you know what? If we were hurting, they were hurting worse. That's all I know. That's all I know.
Yeah, not for nothing. You guys were clearly the top.
Oh, yeah.
And it was nice, like you said, there were enough variety in the magazines, like the After / Weston mags. So they all looked beautiful. The gorgeous typography.
Oh yeah.
And they were just so great looking. And you had the Keitzer mags that were not quite as great looking, but they were a little. I don't want to say like a smart fan, but a little more geared towards on the inside of the business.
They would put real names in the agony pages. I remember that.
That was sort of like a gateway mm-hmm. magazine to the newsletters for me. And then you had like the Napolitano mags, which were just loaded with like awesome bloody color photos. So you had something for everybody, and I'd go down there. I'd go, load up and I get four different magazines, Fangoria and some comic books, and I'd be set for the
back
month,
when you can afford to buy a magazine. Have you ever gone to the newsstand lately?
Like $20, man.
I know, it's insanity. It's crazy. I used to buy every day of my life, I used to buy two newspapers and put them under my arm and read them at lunch for the agate for the baseball, right? Now that would cost me $550 a year to do that. Yeah. Monday through Friday, all year long.
Yeah.
And I can't afford. That's why I read digital newspapers as opposed to buying the print copies. I want to support. I want to support magazines and newspapers. That was my whole life, my whole adult life. So I support them when I can, but I can't afford to buy them. Right. If I could, you know what? If I could afford to buy them, I still wouldn't buy them. I'm not paying $2.75 for a newspaper. It's just not cost effective.
We're
on a slippery slope when it comes to news in this country. Well, that's another topic for another show. But you know,
it's just. I mean, it's everything. I remember as a kid going to the matches, and in Tennessee, the boys got to, if they worked for Ron Fuller, they could sell their own merchandise. So they would be like 8x10s for like, $2. Now, even with inflation to today's money, that may be like 10 bucks, or maybe 15. But now wrestling fans go to matches, and guys are selling that and selfies for $60. I'm thinking, how? Yeah. What? And
I went to a convention last year in Philadelphia, and I was just I had a table. I was just hyping the podcast. I wasn't even selling anything. Just handing a flyer out, and that was it. Talk to people I knew and didn't know. It was fun. But I went up to all these booths, and I won't mention any names, and I saw what these guys were getting for just a simple autograph or the opportunity to take your own picture of them.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. I mean, I don't understand. Well, the first question is, what do these guys do with all their money? But, something that was a wrestling life was hard for the 70s and 80s guys. Even when they were making good coin, you had to pay your own expenses most of the time, depending on what organization you were. You know, Bo. You know what it's like. If you want to bring somebody from not even another state, just down the road a piece, there's extra money involved in that.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to love it to do it. But by the same token, a lot of people really didn't make that much scratch doing it. You know, right. Some did, but most didn't.
And a lot of them, you know, there was merchandise sold, but they didn't get a dime from it. It all went to the office.
Right, right.
You know, that was one of the reasons that Handsome Jimmy left Charlotte for that short period in 84 and went back to Memphis, was because they were selling 8x10s and stuff at Mid-Atlantic. He was getting no money for it. So when he went to Memphis, he could sell it himself, and he was making a killing doing the pitcher money himself on top of what he was making.
Man, you make a great point there. People don't understand. That's why, how could you work in Memphis? Memphis didn't pay like the other tours. Maybe not. But when you were the Rock and Roll Express or the Fabulous Ones, you could stick your gimmick on that table, and you were going to walk out with a nice hunk of change at the end of the night. Yeah. And if they're smart, they'd save their money, but you never know how it works.
Same thing in Continental Southeastern. I saw Danny Davis last week at the deal, and he was talking about the angle in 87 where they had turned Fuller and Golden on the Nightmares over the car that Danny had won in the tournament. And I forget what kind of car it was. It was a fancy sports car for the time in 1987. And Danny told me, he said, I bought that the first week of June. We shot the angle the third week of June of 87. That was all of my pitcher money up to that point for the year. And he goes, $25,000 cash. Oof. That's what he had made in pitcher money. Not his payoffs and not whatever, you know. So, yeah, these small southern territories, oh, they don't pay like New York. Oh, they don't. It didn't. Guys were making pretty good livings. But yes. Some of them were just making a living, depending on who they are, where they're at on the card. And I'm happy the guys are getting out there and getting to make the money. And one of the things that I see all the time at these conventions, and I have a friend, Scott, in Chattanooga that does this, the PWI 500s, and they try to get everybody that's in every year to sign their spot. And I've seen that happen a lot. And, I can't tell you how many of them I've signed over the last 5-7 years or so. And it always makes me smile and always makes me feel good when people bring them to me, because just the memory that I just gave you of me and KC flipping through there going, hey, cuz, we're booked. the phone is getting ready to start ringing because people had that network of, hey, who's this guy right here in the magazine that they're writing about and keep writing about and keep writing about? Because I'm blessed. You pick up a magazine, you will find me in the results or the ratings or somewhere in there. When that weekly came along, so many of my match results were printed in the PWI weeklies. One of my favorite things, and one of the boys said one time, in one of the PWI weeklies where they had the who's hot, who's not.
Yeah, that's right.
I was in the who's not. And it said, Bo James, 5 days, 5 states, 5 losses. So somebody makes some kind of smart comment about it in the dressing room one night, and I said, were you in it? Matters is they're about me. They're not talking about you.
I insist wins and losses have nothing to do with the quality of a professional wrestler. Bo, right. You know this.
Right.
You know, it's a cooperative. It's to make that show work, somebody got to win and somebody got to lose. And sometimes when you lose, you do better than if you won, depending on how that storyline went. You know what I'm saying? So I don't care about how many championships a guy had. I think Johnny Rods was as good a wrestler as anybody I've ever seen. I think Danny Davis is as good a wrestler as anybody I've ever seen. You know, it's the talent. It's what they did behind the scenes. You know, Eric Embry of all people, I have so much respect for, because he could book and then make people boo him an hour later when he walked through that curtain. You know, it's like, those are the people I admire, and I don't care about the wins and losses. And right. You know what? I think a lot of fans feel the same way if they're the real smart fans, not the fans who think they're the smart fans.
Yeah. Right. That's Handsome. Riding with Jimmy Valiant is a teenager, early 20s. Handsome is my wrestling dad. And when, like you said, the newsletters took off, I'm traveling with Handsome at that time, and I would have him, and we would look at it. He never looked at him. I'd tell him what was in him. And, you know, these supposed smart fans love to just bury him and bury Paul Jones. They were terrible. And I say, whoa. They had a program that lasted for 4 years that drew money constantly for 4 years. That's all that matters. It's a business. Just like the magazines that is based on the rest, it's a business. The wrestling magazines loved Handsome because he was a character. He had the bloody pictures. He had all the stuff. The newsletters hated Handsome because they couldn't understand him. But one valuable lesson that I always learned, and it came when I started getting the magazine coverage, and we would be somewhere, and I would see one, pick it up, and I'd show Handsome, hey, look. And Handsome says, never believe your own press. Someone is saying that about you because they're paid to fill that magazine. Be thankful that they think enough of you to put you in that magazine. And as long as they spell your name right, that's all that matters. And that's something that I have lived by for the last 36 years. And I love the wrestling business. And I wish we could go back to having the magazines and the old stories the way they were. But that day time is over.
Yeah,
but we all got to be a part of it one way or the other, whether we were reading it, whether we were in it, or whether we were writing it. The three of us got to be a part of it.
Now, here's the beauty part, though, Bo. You know, first of all, when you first contacted me about this, I didn't think you were the Bo James. I didn't think anybody lasted in the business that long. No, I'm serious. I'm deadly serious. Remember, I said, well, I need to know more about it. And then you wrote, and I went, whoops, I know this guy. Shoot. Right? So I thought just somebody picked the name up, you know, because, you know, there's probably a nature boy running around out there somewhere. You know how it works. But here's the beauty part about all this. We can't make the old days come back, but we can sure love them the way we used to.
Yeah.
And we can express it to other people. And I'm finding out that a lot of people feel the way you and I do in terms of the psychology of wrestling from the old days. People miss it. And it's nice to be able to find other people to talk to this stuff about, because it meant a lot to all of us growing up. And me as a professional, geez, I got a job with PWI answering a two-line ad in the New York Times. Two-line little ad. And I figured out who they were and what they was. When I walked in, I was totally prepared.
Yeah.
And, dude, I'm always grateful for that blessing. You know, to land in a place I couldn't imagine ever working for, ever. I mean, I started my small town paper in Catskill, New York, went to a bigger newspaper. Next thing I know, a year and a half after I started my career, I was with PWI. That doesn't happen to most near mortals. You know, I got very, very lucky. So all I can say is the fun of this to me has nothing to do with money. As you know, I made a nice living in PWI. Shoot, I talked to a full-time AWA wrestler who told me I made more than he did when I was with PWI.
Yeah.
Okay. So I never, here I am sitting on my duff and some guy's busting his ass four nights a week and he's making less than I am. How is that possible? I was thinking at that time. So, you know, the way to success is not always paved with gold. You know, it just isn't. But you know what? You have to love the art form. I love the art form. I loved it more then than I do now. So that's what the whole idea, outdated wrestling, outdated is another word to me for classic.
Yeah.
I could have called it the classic. No, I want outdated hour just sounded musical to me. So that's what I did. And you know what? I'm finding out so many people. And anytime I talk to somebody like you, Bo, or somebody from the 70s are still around, I am so happy.
This is Handsome's 60th year being involved in wrestling.
Crazy. You know?
And you know, he was the headliner for the Memphis Hall of Fame last week. I mean, and I did the induction, and before we went out, I went over to him and I said, anything you want me to say? And he goes, no, you know me. I know you. You love me. I love you. He said, just speak from your heart. And I did. And he came out and he spoke from his heart and he talked about the 60 years. And he said, hey, I still got stuff left to do. He still has things and places that he wants to see and go and be a part of. And that's what drives me, is seeing people like that are still driven. And he was so patient with people coming through the fanfare that day. He, you know, and handsome, it's no secret, he's in his 80s. You know, but he still loves this business. Every Sunday, his museum is open in Charlottesville, Virginia. And people come from all around the country and all around the world to see this museum. And he takes them on a tour and shows them little, like he'll get over in the corner and there'll be a picture, you know, like an inch by inch, like in the original write-ups of the results of this person versus that person. And he'll say, look at that. That's from The Wrestler, 1973. That was my first feature or whatever. And I'm like, one, how does he know where that's at in this museum? Two, how can he possibly remember what it came from? But he has that passion for this business. And you have to have it, whether you're covering it, whether you're a part of it. And at some point, and a lot of people now are piling on the guys that write the newsletters. That when we first saw the newsletters, they were brand new and they were exciting. And holy crap, you get to see this and know this. Somebody's talking to somebody that shouldn't be talking. Now, this generation of internet fan attacks the older newsletter writers about they get this wrong or they get that wrong or whatever. And some of it they do and some of it they don't. But I think for some of them, somewhere along the way, they lost the passion and it just became a job.
But you know what? That's a good point. And let me expand on that. The difference when you and I were fans, when we were younger, and this is the passage of time that's changed all this, was that when you and I bought our ticket to a match, we were there to see our favorite wrestler beat that bad guy.
That's it.
Or to see the bad guy. But that was as far as our mindset went. We didn't know what was going on backstage. We didn't know the real names. We didn't care to. We were there to see the action and the thrills in that ring. Right? Yeah. Or hear a good interview maybe once in a while. Now, the fan sits in the front row or the fifth row or up in the bleachers, and he's booking along with the booker. He's saying, this guy's not getting pushed right. He's going, this is an angle I don't like. This is blah, blah, blah. Because the door has been cracked open. The Wizard of Oz has been seen.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like everybody knows everything, and they're too busy evaluating angles and what they would have done rather than just sitting back and enjoying the matches. I say, keep yourself in the dark. You'll have more fun. Am I right?
Right?
Sit back and let the entertainment unfold in front of you. You don't go to a magic show and hope that at the end of the thing, they show you how the lady got sawed in half, do you? No.
Right.
Right? You want to just enjoy that program that you're watching. You paid good hard-earned money to go and watch. And all I can say is I'm glad the WWE is doing so well. I really am. They're filling up football stadiums all over the world. You can't begrudge them. But for somebody who's watched every day since 1970, like I have, I don't take the pleasure in it anymore because it's as much with the current product and I'm not putting anybody down. I'm just saying the mindset has changed so much that it doesn't resemble what I watched back then.
Right.
It's all different. 20 minutes to walk to the ring, major special effects and, you know, gimmicks that are so outlandish that everybody knows they're fake. You know, I don't know what to say other than the whole vibe is different. And I'm not putting them down. I'm just knowing that I'm not satisfied with it. But then again, I got a gray hair and advertisers don't care about me anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
I did not watch the modern product for probably 20 years. Because one, in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I got the TV here and we expanded the TV coverage of what we were doing and we're running more towns, and I'm working with more promoters, and I got to focus on what I'm doing. And then different things happened in different ways, and I got away from watching or even keeping up with the wrestling business. But then comes along my little Waylon, my little grandnephew, and my little niece, grandniece Aubrey, and they fell in love with wrestling. And they're WWE fans. I just took a road trip with my little niece and her daddy to Handsome's Museum a few weeks ago for Handsome's birthday. And we get in the car, and the first thing Aubrey says is, "Uncle Bo, did you watch SummerSlam last night?" And I said, "No, baby, I was wrestling in West Virginia. I didn't get to see it." She told me the result of every match on that pay-per-view. She knew everything. Waylon sits here and watches, and I watch with him, and he goes, he tells me about, "Hey, I can't wait till The Rock and Roman Reigns get back together because they're going to get them bad Samoans." You know, they believe in their, so that is still there to a point in age until somebody is, ruins it for them. My boys that work for me, because Waylon hates the heels that work for me. Oh, he despises them. And he's always yelling at them or stuff, and he's around them, so he has contact with them, but he'll call them names or stick his tongue out and run, or he'll throw something at them. It's funny to watch.
That is beautiful, man. That's beautiful. That's the goods right there. I love it.
So a couple of them said, "Hey, smarten him up." I said, "Not a chance. I'm not going to ruin this for him." I said, "Here's the deal. Let them believe as long as they can believe." As a kid, I believed. As you said, we went to see our favorite wrestler get even with that dirty bad guy. I went to see gladiators fight to the death. Now, there's had to be a couple of moments in Waylon's life where I've had to say, "Listen, come here. No matter what happens out there, I'm not dying. I'm not this. You know, you can be concerned, but don't be scared. You know, something may happen." So, because he still holds a grudge against Murphy Costigan for punching me in the heart after I'd had the heart issue, and I took the heart punch at the fairgrounds in my hometown, and there's thousands of people there that thought he just killed him right in front of us. And I had to be taken out of the ring. So Waylon hates Murphy with a passion for that reason. And every time that we go to wrestling, he goes, "I just hope you kill Murphy tonight." And I say, first of all, Waylon, don't wish that on anybody, and ain't nobody killing nobody, but I'm going to try to get him, you know. But that's, I love that. I fell in love during the pandemic with the wrestling business again, mm-hmm. watching my little baby niece and nephew sitting there watching every week and watching it through their eyes, watch this product. I don't understand everything. I don't agree with everything. I don't like everything that I see, but there's stuff that I see and I go, "Man, that was really good."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me that, too. Yeah, sure.
You know, whoa, they've got something here. And we watch the big events. Me and Waylon and his dad will sit and watch like the WrestleManias and this, you know, and I go into it with an open mind. Unlike almost everyone else sitting there questioning it, I don't question anything, because here's the fact. I don't know what they're going to. I don't know what they're going to do next. I don't work in that office. I'm not involved in the booking meetings. I'm not involved in anything. So why should the fans have that same thought process of, "Well, I would have did it this way," or "I would have did it that way"? And because they all believe that they're smart. They're not sitting there waiting to read news that's 6, 8, 12 weeks behind going, "Wow, I can't believe this happened." And by the time we get it and read it, that situation, for most part, had already been blown off and they're moved on to another situation. Mm-hmm. But through the magazines, we got to see what was happening. The longest week of my life was March of 1983, waiting for Mid-Atlantic Wrestling to come on to find out if Slaughter and Carnoodle lost the tag titles or if Steamboat and Youngblood had to break up. I only got 2.5 channels at home then. the ABC only came in if it was snowing or raining or the wind was blowing just right. My granny had cable, and I remember sitting there that day when we finally find out. A full week later, we find out. And Bob Caudle comes on, and Johnny Weaver say brand new world tag team champions, and my granny goes, yes. Now they want it instant. Now they want to know right now. I can wrestle in a small town in the hills of Virginia or Kentucky or West Virginia, and before I even get out of the ring and get to the dressing room and sit down, somebody has already tagged me in pictures from the match I just had on my Facebook. They want it right now. And I believe that has hurt everything, not just how we get our wrestling news. Mm-hmm. And here's something else, Bob, and correct me if I'm wrong on this. You guys had you could work within the parameters of the business of reporting stuff or doing interviews or whatever, but you could not falsify what actually is happening in the programs or in the, you know, you had to be held accountable for what you reported. As long as it fit within, you didn't just make up a story of saying, you know, after the match, you know, Ric Flair went back and beat up Dusty Rhodes' kids in the dressing room. But you see stories like that that get out now, not, I'm just using that kind of story, but you see stuff that you go, who reported this? Where did this come from? And it's because everybody online thinks they're a journalist now. Mm-hmm. Everybody online believes they're in on the business. Yeah. So they'll report something, and there's somebody that will believe it and repost it or send it or, you know.
And you got a lot of these cheesy wrestling websites that are these SEO sites that will take one piece of erroneous information, cut and paste it onto their site.
That's our headline.
Exactly. So I'm with you. Listen, you know as well as I did, we wrote a lot of kayfabe articles. You know, it's a lot of not everything that you saw was really happened, but we would never go to the extreme of doing physical stuff in an article that never happened. He couldn't do that. Right. It would be on television. It would be reported.
Yeah.
You know, so now I just, by the way, I got to back up a little bit. You're a good granddad, man. To tell your kid what he's watching ain't real is like telling him there's no Santa Claus. That's beautiful.
Right.
You're doing the right thing, man. You're doing the absolute right thing. Let him enjoy it. He'll figure it out in time. That's the key.
And I tell all of my heels, I say, look, when he gets with it, and one day when he's the boss, he's going to use a little bit of you, and he's going to borrow a little bit of you because you're the first people that he hated. The greatest wrestling ever in the world is what the wrestling of your childhood was. And I still borrow from my childhood.
Yes. I always refer to that. And I'll tell you something else, and you know this better than anybody else. Somebody's watching a villainous or bad guy wrestler in your ring, and 25 years from now, there's going to be a wrestling convention, and somebody's going to walk up, shake the hand of that villain, go, man, I hated you. Can I have your autograph?
Yeah.
Only wrestling does that.
Only
pro wrestling can hate, despise this guy for two decades, and then I can't wait to meet him. Real life ain't like that, you know? If you don't like somebody personally, you stay away from them. No. Only in wrestling can you hate somebody and want to meet them.
The first person that I despised, I hated as a kid, as a fan, was Sir Oliver Humperdinck. Because he had that big program with the House of Humperdinck against Handsome Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, years later, I'm in the business, I'm with Handsome somewhere, and I meet Humperdinck. The one and only time I ever got to meet him, Handsome introduces me to him, and I said, I'm going to give you the greatest compliment I can give you. I hated your guts. And he starts laughing, and he goes, I did my job.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, it's like, gosh, I used to despise, even in the more recent years, I used to despise the Honky Tonk Man. I didn't think he was as good as anybody else. Right. But then a passage of time goes by and I realize, man, he did his job. It's like The Miz these days.
Yeah.
The Miz makes you so angry. And then you realize, wait a minute, that's not the real guy. He's doing his job and doing it well. You know, who's the guy just lost the the U.S. title. Logan Paul. Now, he's got a lot of talent. But
yeah.
Even at my old wizzled age, I'm watching him going, what an obnoxious SOB. God almighty. Oh, and then you have to sit back and go, is that really him? Probably not. You know, he's doing his job and doing it well. To make you despise him like that, even an old fart like me who knows better, he's doing his job and doing it well, man. That's all I got to say.
John, you got any more questions?
One question. I don't know if you were there at PWI at this time still, but this is the one. This has always fascinated me. 1997, Dean Malenko as the number one.
Oh yeah, I was gone by then. That's an editorial decision. I don't think I would have done that.
That always it always struck me as so strange. As
here's the thing. He was a great wrestler. There's no question about that.
Yes, absolutely.
A real ring general, a guy who knew everything and could do everything. Question was, he was never going to get promoted like that.
Man.
See, there's the difference. He was worthy of that spot. If you break it down and forget, if you're looking at it from straight athleticism, sure, he could have been number one at that point in his life. Sure, absolutely. Trouble was, he was never going to get promoted like that. Man.
Right.
He never won a world title, did he? I can't remember that stuff. Yeah. Everything after 1980 is a blur for me. He might have won one of the belts at one point. I don't know. But, you know, he was never going to be Backlund or San Martino or a long-lasting remembered world champion. People remember him for his technical ability, which is great. I think that's wonderful. But I didn't understand it at the time either, to be honest with you. I didn't agree with it. I didn't think he sold enough tickets, to be honest with you.
In the magazine, there was almost like a three-page explanation / disclaimer about why he got the number one spot. And it was like, well, Hogan was doing this, and Bret Hart was out doing this, and Shawn Michaels was out, and blah, blah, blah. So it was very interesting how they preemptively sort of did damage control.
They shoved them to the front on the basis of failures of others, I guess. Yeah.
Right. And then I think he sort of buried the 500 list, like when he was asked about it, which is sort of. Like,
you mean in real life?
Yeah.
Tell me about it. What are you talking about?
I think it was something like, oh, it doesn't mean anything. All that matters is my paycheck. The belt is a work. The ratings are a work. Blah, blah, blah. All that matters is my money. Something along. I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly, but it was.
I have felt like that many times in my career. did the check clear? That's the big thing, right? I mean, there are times we all feel, and if you don't feel that way, something wrong with you, man. Yeah. I mean, it's like we all got to eat, so. I would have been a little more diplomatic if I was him, but he's got a right to feel that way. That's fine.
I'm paraphrasing, so he may have been more diplomatic.
There's this old mindset of the wrestling business. If you have to explain it, it's not over. If you have to explain it, it's not going to get over.
Mm-hmm.
So by them having to explain why Dean was number one, and I love Dean, and I'm not taking nothing
me
away
too.
From
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No. But like Bob said, he didn't sell enough tickets and was not going to sell enough tickets. People ask me all the time, who's the greatest wrestler of all time? And I said, by what qualification? Well, who was the best? I said, well, we have no batting average. Yeah. We have no, the only thing that we can look at and judge by is money drawn.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Thinking back to that Malenko, was he ever on the cover as the central feature of PWI before or after that? I don't know that question.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really.
Here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking whoever was running the show at that point was going, we got to please the Smarks. The Smart Marks. We got to please the Smarks. The business is changing. Let's make our view different than it used to be. And I think that may have been the key back then because I wasn't there, but I saw how the business was changing at that point.
Yeah.
So I bet that's what the decision. We got to please those Smarks. Huh. We got to win them back. We got to give them a reason to buy this magazine.
And even the wrestling companies were booking towards the smart fans.
Yeah,
you know, at that point. So yeah, that's what I've always thought of that. It had to be. And Dean, I know Dean, and Dean is a heck of a guy. You know, John and I just met his brother out in Waterloo, Iowa, at the Hall of Fame this. Summer. He was a heck of a guy, you know, but that number one spot in wrestling, whether it's the 500, whether it's the dressing room, whether it's the ring, whether it's whatever, that number one spot belongs to whoever's drawing the most money.
Right.
That's it. It's a business.
That's exactly right. Yes, indeed. I can't argue with that at all. Or it should be. That should be what it
is. So, Bob, tell us about the outdated Wrestling Hour and where everybody can find it.
I'm going to make it real simple. And you know, I've learned to do this. It's a podcast about, well, the old days. We'll talk about some new stuff once in a while, but it's mostly about the old days, and you never know who's going to show up. You never know what we're going to talk about. So we try to keep it whimsical. We try to keep some really good music, good theme songs and whatnot. John, you mentioned the theme song before. I appreciate that. Here's how you find it. Go to your browser, type in Outdated Wrestling Hour. Boop, pops right up. I could tell you a bunch of other stuff, but if you're new to me and new to the show, just do that. You'll find it. I also do another podcast called the Outdated Entertainment Hour, where we're looking at old stuff. We just did a top 100 TV series of all time that goes back to the 50s and 60s and 70s. So I'm parlaying the Outdated brand into the whole mess of different offshoots. I'm having a blast. That's the only reason I'm doing it. I'm just having fun. I'm hoping that people listen and have fun. Like I just had fun with John and Bo. I hope it's enjoyable. That's all I'm looking to do, man.
I have not got to the Entertainment Hour yet. I enjoy the Outdated Wrestling Hour. I've not got over to the Entertainment Hour yet, but I'm looking forward to that.
Yes.
And it's on the last episode it was a week after. I had spent the weekend at a festival with the kids from the Brady Bunch.
And, wow.
And it was Bobby, Cindy, and Greg, and all three of them said, hey, how do we get one of those posters? We've never been on wrestling advertisement before. And I said, don't worry. So I went and got, I had, because the festival, was we were wrestling at the festival. The advertisement also had the Brady kids come to the wrestling, blah, blah, blah. Plus meet the Brady Bunch, food trucks, blah, 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 blah. So they thought it was so cool to be on a wrestling advertisement. I went and had some more printed for them and had all the boys that wrestled that weekend sign it. And I took and gave them all posters to take home with them. And they thought it was so cool that they were on wrestling advertisement. And I thought it was so cool that we were on with the Brady Bunch on advertisement. So it's a crazy world.
That's for sure, man. Absolutely.
So I'm going to wrap this edition of the, Outlaws, the Independence podcast up, and John and I are still doing research. And we've had some feedback just in the last week from China and from Germany. Thank you guys for listening all around the world. Make sure, if you have not already, we've got a Facebook page, Outlaws, the Independence. We've got the Twitter page, Outlaws Pod, Instagram, Outlaws, the Independence. We're sharing stuff. We'll be sharing a lot of stuff when this episode drops from the early 500, so you can see some of Bob's work. And Bob, again, thank you for keeping me and my boys booked for a long time ahead when those magazines came out. I don't know if you guys up there in New York knew how much you were helping us independent wrestlers at the time, how you were helping put our brand out there, put our name out there, and we are forever thankful for the my generation of wrestler that got that coverage after the territories went down. We couldn't have bought it. We couldn't have got it any other way. And thanks to you and Bill After and that whole staff that you guys had, you were able to give some of us great lives for a long time.
That's wonderful. You know, here's the deal too. I mean, I was lucky enough to be with that last era when wrestling magazines meant something, that you could read about people you haven't seen and help wrestlers get booking because they were in the books. I'm happy to have a legacy like that. And it was a lot of fun. And I just want to let you know, John and Bo, I never had more fun doing a podcast. This was great. I really appreciate it. This was fun for me. I mean, you guys know we have a similar mindset and it worked out great. And and folks, you don't know this yet, but we're going to have Bo on my show because it's like I got more stuff to go over with him. So you better show up when I tell you. You hear me?
Me and John tried to record this and do this podcast as just friends having a conversation.
Right.
most you're our first guest on this podcast. We're new, but we do so much history research and we do so much everything to put this podcast out, because we talk about guys from before. We have a cutoff, nothing past 1999. That's our cutoff. So a lot of this stuff we have to research by going back to the old magazines and the newspapers and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And we talked on the phone this week and John said, "Hey, do we got an outline of what we're going to talk to Bob about?" I said, "No, we're going to call it in the ring." I said, we know the 500, we know the weekly, we know the magazines, we live for those magazines. We don't need an outline or anything else. So this has been great. I hope everybody listening is joining this. Go subscribe to the Outdated Wrestling Hour if you have not already. Bob, what is your Facebook and other social media?
Okay, you can find me on Facebook as just plain old Bob Smith, but I'm the only Bob Smith singing with B.B. King on the lead page. I was a blues musician for 15 years in between these things.
No.
And I actually made 4 albums and as the name of Robert Charles, and I went out and had a career doing that. It was great. So look for me singing with B.B. King on my Facebook page. I'm also, leave it at that, because I'm on Twitter and Threads, but I'm hardly ever on them, so I would let that just work out for itself. If you want to write to us and get more information, it's real easy. outdatedwrestling@gmail.com. Just that simple. And I think that's good. And like I said, you can also find me on the wrestlecopia.com. That's the network I just signed with. The podcast just joined the network, and I'm grateful for that. So, just find us. Like I said, to make things easy, just type Outdated Wrestling in your browser. You'll find me one way or another.
I tried it. It comes up. It's the first thing that comes up.
Yeah,
it comes right up.
Yep, it comes right up. So I'm learning it rather than rattle off a bunch of stuff. Just do that. It's just as easy, right?
That's why I try to keep everything King of Kingsport.
Yep. So,
John, give them your Twitter and stuff where they can follow you.
Oh, yeah. JON_BOUCHER. That's me on Twitter, or X, I guess we call it now. Follow me there for some wrestling content occasionally, follow me there, please.
All right, Bob, thank you. This has been great. We've had such fun doing this. We're going to bring you back at some point.
Oh yeah,
we're going to come across something where you covered something that we need to talk about on this show. So
okay,
you will be back at some point.
I will say this: I had so much fun. I will come running. I'm serious.
Awesome.
I will. If you want to do it 3 a.m. on a Wednesday, I'll do it. I'm telling you, I had so much fun. So yeah, please, I'll hold you to that. I want to be back on the show because I want to have more fun.
Fantastic.
John's usually out collecting debts at that time of the year.
Oh man,
John, as always, thank you for being my co-host. I hope you've had as much fun as me and Bob have had.
I have, of course. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, everybody. We will be back in a couple of weeks with something else here on Outlaws to Independence. God bless all of you. Please follow me on social media so as I give you help where you can help the flood victims here in East Tennessee that desperately need it, and in Western North Carolina. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Carpal's up, boys. Get out in the room filled up with law. They came panic through the back door in the middle of my song. Got me for possession of something that was gone.